yourself someday.
Hello, world. Welcome to Living to Write, where we talk with notable writers about their methods, journeys, and advice for other writers. I'm Brian Landwehr. I'm a writer, and if you are too, or just want to learn more about writers and how and why they do what they do, you're in the right place. And with me each episode is my bestie, Bailey Patterson, who is both a talented writer and producer of this nerdy little podcast. Hello over there, Bailey.
Hey, bestie. Hello, world.
Today, we're getting into a couple topics we haven't touched on much, writing for animation and writing for a very young audience. Preschoolers, in this case, which I have on good authority is not as easy as people might assume. So, Bailey, please tell our audience who you found for us today.
It's going to be an interesting conversation. Our guest today is James Eason Garcia. He's co-executive producer and a writer over at Disney Junior.
So, James got his start as a production coordinator on Disney's Elena of Avalor. And then he was a writer on Disney Junior's Young Jedi Adventures before moving on to his current role as story editor on the popular Iron Man and His Awesome Friends. So his work, as I understand it, is targeting preschoolers, while he's also doing an interesting mix of genre work, and he's also participating in the big cinematic universes of existing IP. None of that sounds straightforward. So this will be interesting to hear how he's been so successful for so long managing all of that.
Absolutely. And let's not forget, James has a collection of, I think, over 30,000 comic books, Brian. So if we can get into that.
30,000.
I believe so. We'll
We're going to do our journalistic duty and confirm that in the interview, I hope.
Oh, please. I hope so. Anybody who has 30,000 comic books.
Yeah. So James is a colorful character. I like that. But of course he is. He's a writer. Let's confirm all this by getting him in here. What do you say? Are you ready?
Let's do it, brother.
All right. Dear listeners, we now give you James Eason Garcia.
Lights, camera, action.
Hello, James. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, James.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're excited to talk with you today about writing for animation and for young audiences. So thank you for taking the time.
Of course. Let's dig in. Let's talk about it.
Okay. Well, I'll get you started with either a softball question or the deepest question you've ever been asked. It depends on how you treat it. So you just have fun with it. And that question is this: why are you a writer? Why?
Ooh, wow.
I will accept 30-second answers and 30-minute answers.
The softball answer is because I'm probably not good enough at anything else.
No.
Honestly, I don't ever think I've known a time in my life where, like, I wasn't incredibly invested in writing and storytelling. Like, even from, like, a really young age, I was a voracious reader and I loved watching animated shows, mm-hmm. and I didn't understand that, like, the story ended when the episode ended. So I would start writing little, like, stories that were like, and then this happened on DuckTales, and then this character came in, and I would keep doing that and didn't realize, like looking back on it now, I was writing fan fiction before, like, fan fiction was, like, a really well-known thing.
You invented your own fan fiction extensions of the episodes that you were enjoying.
Yeah. And so I think that's kind of where I originally started writing. But I look back on it, I was like, I was really, like, taking in the episodes. I wasn't just kind of, like, passively watching. I was taking in and figuring out, like, story structure and what character needed to be there and the voices and all that kind of stuff. So it was, that's just kind of where it started. I remember, like, a lot of my aunts and uncles will tell stories about me being young and me just coming and just fabricating stories out of nowhere, just coming up with, like, little anecdotes and stories and things like that. And they were like, where are you coming up with this? And I'm like, doesn't everybody think this way? and as I've learned as an adult, not everyone does. But yeah, so I think that's just always kind of been something that I've been drawn to. And I guess maybe the deeper answer is I sometimes find real life to be a little boring and a little mundane. So I'm always creating that fantasy, that excitement, that action, that adventure that I kind of wish I could see in the world more often.
That's fantastic. I mean, the best thing, the most reliable thing you can do as an artist is put into the world what you wish were there. You can't chase a trend or, you know, chase an opportunity in the industry. You've just got to make what you want to be watching and hope that there are other people who'd like to be watching that too.
Oh, for sure. I 100% agree that the chasing the trends is an impossible task. It will almost always end in failure.
Sure.
But when you're true to yourself, when you're true to your vision, like, we're not all so unique that, like, we don't have similar sensibilities, that there aren't a lot of other people that don't find the same things funny or the same situations exciting. So right. You kind of just have to, like you said, lean into what entertains you first and believe that the audience is there for that same kind of content.
Right. But we all have enough overlap that the Joseph Campbell's hero's journey works for all of us. We all have these myths that push our buttons, but we also have different tastes and like different focuses. So that makes sense to me that you're putting what you'd like to see out there in the world, and yet you are not 6 years old. So what is it that drew you to writing for kids? I think we've already covered where the initial animation draw came from, but why, as an adult, still wanting to write for that younger version of yourself?
I think for me, animation has always just been such an amazing medium. Again, like going back to like the idea of like seeing the fantasy in the world that doesn't, like the fantasy or like a different version of the world that doesn't exist. And now we're in a place where live action can do some amazing things that give you that fantasy. I mean, that's how we have like Game of Thrones and, you know, Walking Dead and all this other kind of like amazing, like high fantasy live action dramas. But growing up as a kid, like the only place I could really find that was in animation. So I've always just had a deep love for animated films and animation as an art craft. And I think I would have loved to have been an animator myself at some point, but I also I think writing's the only skill I really, really have. I didn't have the talent to draw and animate the way I saw other people being able to do it. And I just knew I wanted to be in that space. So it was always something that was just always kind of calling to me, just the animation. And once I finally got my foot in the door, I started off on the production side of things. It was just such an amazing experience. I spent a little bit of time in production, being a PA in live action, and then I got to do PA in animation, and I liked animation a lot more. there was just, there's more of a camaraderie, and it might be because the process of animation is so long. I mean, we started writing episodes of Iron Man and His Awesome Friends in April of 2023, and we didn't premiere until August of 2025. So it was over two full years of producing, you know, our first handful of episodes. And to me, like, that camaraderie builds over time, especially in the writer's room. My writers and I were working for years together as a team. You really get to know each other. You really get to know each other's sensibility. And I think because of the process of animation takes so long, the byproduct is the team that you're working with, you really get to know and trust and kind of become a family. And that was something I didn't know I was going to discover until I actually got into animation. And it really pulled me in and made me that's where I wanted to be.
Going from production associate to executive producer, let's say, what did you learn on that process, climbing that ladder? Of course, you're going to absorb things like a sponge, but just in terms of screenwriting, was there one screenwriting habit that helped you climb that ladder? Or what did you learn from that experience that helped you, you know, take it into the room?
I think I was told this pretty early on. I worked as a PA in Elena Bavalor, became a production coordinator, and that's where I really started working on my writing. Again, my undergrad, I was a focus on writing, but like now that I was in it, I was like, I need to kind of like, with all the knowledge I'd gained working on the show, I needed to kind of tackle screenwriting again. And so I shared one of my scripts with one of the other writers, Kate Condell, on the show, on Elena Bavalor. And she came to me and she was like, you have a superpower. And I said, what is that? And she goes, you understand the pipeline better than any writer I've ever met. You understand every step of production. And it was just because my time on Elena had been sitting in every room with the showrunner, with the director, with the art director, reviewing everything and taking notes on everything. So all that, you know, again, being a sponge and just soaking all that in, when I sat down and wrote my first script, I was writing for a finished product, not for a script. I was writing for like what the show was going to be once it aired, and was being clever when it came to, you know, how many voice actors I was using, how many assets were going to have to be created. Because that's a big thing in animation, right? Like, you can't just like say it's set in a mall and a mall just exists. Like, somebody has to design that mall and every single extra that's in that mall. And that becomes a huge burden on production if that shot's only 10 seconds long. Like, do you really need that mall scene? And so I was writing for a finished product. I wasn't writing for the page.
And you're saying that she had this opinion about your superpower and your understanding of the entire pipeline was just from looking at what you'd put on the page. This isn't from talking with you. This is from picking up your pages, and she could see all that right there.
Yeah, I've been working with her, so she'd already like known me as a production person around the show, but
sure.
Just off the script, she pulled that out and she was like, you're writing in ways where you're thinking budget, you're thinking schedule, you're thinking all these other things, which again is my job as an EP, as a co-EP on Iron Man, is to be constantly thinking, where is this going to get crunchy down the line for the rest of my show?
How do the skills that are needed for writing for your particular audience, a lot of five and up, where do those particular skills come from, and how do they differ from writing for an older audience? And have you done a lot of writing for an older audience, or has this been almost entirely your focus?
Majority of my time as a writer, as a screenwriter, a story editor has all been in this preschool, younger age things. I do, of course, have feature films and sample scripts that I've written that are that age up. But where I've really found a lot of joy and what I've really found success in my career is making stuff for that little version of me. And I think that's kind of what I'm doing every day, is what would have really tickled me and entertained me as a kid. My showrunner, Sean Coyle, and I talk about this all the time. We're just like, we're basically just entertaining ourselves as like 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds. And like going back to like what I was saying, when I was a kid and I was writing this stuff, that's kind of where I got this love of writing and storytelling, was from children's animation and kids' animation. And now being at a point in my life and my career where I can create that stuff for them has just been a really rewarding and exciting experience. I will say, it's not as easy as everybody thinks it is. Everybody thinks, oh, it's for preschool, it's gotta be really easy because it's, you know, but the hardest thing about it is unlearning all the things we learn to become a good writer. And that sounds weird, but as good writers, we wanna be poetic, we wanna be flowery, we wanna be very descriptive. We want to be able to like lean on our crutches of humor and maybe swear words or, you know, whatever. Like there's things that we develop as our natural voice going to school and practicing our craft, that when you get into writing for preschool, you kind of have to pare these things back. Now, it's not about losing those skills as a good writer, but we can't rely on language and jokes the way you can for an older audience, because a lot of our audience is still just learning language and can't tell what sarcasm is, our snark, are these kinds of things that we rely on for humor or even storytelling. So it's also becomes a part about stripping away that part of you that wants to be like, I'm an important writer and every word I write is gold and, you know, magic. And it's kind of about, no, take that away and write as if you were a kid telling a story to another kid. And to me, that's the hardest thing I think people have to learn when they're coming into preschool space. And I think it's the biggest misconception, is that everybody just thinks it's easy, but there's this side to it that does make it more difficult.
Writing it as if you were a kid telling a story to another kid. I guess that would help you keep metaphor out of the way, maybe avoidance of being too on the nose in your dialogue. It's like, well, no, it's okay to be a little on the nose here. We want to be clear about things.
Yeah, I think specifically for our show, because it's superhero, right? There's some aspects of it that are outside of kids' normal everyday experience, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
We're very lucky in our show that, you know, it's set in basically a mirror version of our world. It's not so different from things that kids see every day. There's kids and there's playgrounds and there's cars and there's ice cream and all things that are relatable to them as children. But then we add in superpowers and supervillains and flying suits and Captain America and all these, you know, all these like ideas that aren't things that are relatable to them. So there's always a little bit of extra scene setting for the audience to kind of hold their hand a little bit as we're telling them these stories, because we don't want to just introduce concepts to them and move along and they don't understand that concept, so they can't follow us. So it's a little bit of, it's always a little bit of finding the fun in games and how can we set up, oh, Captain America does this cool thing with his shield in a fun, playful way that's entertaining while also kind of educating, like, oh, this is something cool that Captain America can do with his shield. That then once it's playing out in story later on, it's the kids have come along with it because they understand now.
It's so interesting, like you said, you know, you're writing to a kid, you're telling a kid a story. But when you're doing that, I imagine you have to, you know, you still have to balance heart, you still have to balance humor, and these stories are still structured in a way aimed at younger audiences, of course. But I mean, I imagine a lot of these shows are being watched with their parents. Do you ever consider it's something that the adults can still enjoy too? Or is it just, you're just really focused on the kids? I would love to know what's in your mind there.
Yeah, I was talking earlier about kind of setting aside the like artsiness of writing.
Yeah.
The thing that I don't want to be like misunderstood is that like in the writer's room, in the process, we are still putting a lot of time and effort and thought into how everything is going to work. We're not walking into a script just being like, it's for kids, like dumb ourselves down. You know, it's the structure and the working behind the scenes is still there to figure out how to put that heart into it, put that humor into it, put that action into it. So all that stuff's being done before, you know, any of the writers actually sit down and touch the page of the actual script. But by the time they get there, then that's when they're like, okay, I know all these gears we want to turn. I know all these levers we want to pull for the story because we've worked all it out as a group. And now I need to do all those, going back to what I said about me being a kid telling the story to a kid. For preschool in general, you know, the audience really is specifically this younger group of kids, you know, 2, 4, 5, 6, which again is a crazy age because a 2-year-old is a lot different than a 6-year-old. And it doesn't seem that way, but when you really sit down and like we'll do testing with kids to see like what's popping for them, what are they like understanding? And sometimes it'll be a room with 2, 3, 4-year-olds, and sometimes it'll be a room with 4, 5, 6-year-olds, and what they understand and what they don't understand are vastly different. So that's a really interesting balancing act we have to play too. Is like we have to be able to bring the youngest audience in with us, but still entertain the older kids who are about to age out of this group. One thing that was really important to us on our show was to always make sure that everything we were doing could still be entertaining to anyone who's sitting with the kids. Like we didn't ever want the parents to be like, oh no, they're singing the same like I've Got a Help song a million times over. And it's you know, we have moments where things have to repeat, but we want to change each one of those repeatable moments to make it feel a little bit fresh and exciting for the kid watching it at home, but also for, you know, the older siblings or the parents or the grandparents. One of my favorite things that we were able to do on the show is we do have our armor up sequence, which is, you know, basically kids are having a good fun day. Villain shows up. Villain's going to do something bad. And the kids are like, okay, we've got to armor up to save the day. And, you know, it's a 30-second sequence that basically gets repeated every episode. But we tried to find interesting, fun ways to play with that. So it wasn't just like a plug and play every episode. Like, we just took the same 30 seconds of animation and plugged it into every episode. You know, if we do have a different character in, like Black Panther or Captain America or Iron Spider, and they're armoring up with them, we added new elements to show them armoring up in the sequence and them doing different little things. So it just kind of, for me as a kid, I liked those repeatable moments, but I also liked when they like added something new. Like, I think I know what to expect here. And then they did a twist on you. I was like, oh wow, that's not the same armor up sequence I see every episode. And so it was real. It's really fun for me still as an adult to be like, oh wow, that's really cool. Like, maybe Iron Hulk isn't in this episode, but Captain America is. And now we get to see Captain America armoring up alongside Iron Man and Ironheart, which is fun and unexpected.
Well, I love that. And plus just the concept of giving kids the expectation that, hey, flex your pattern recognition skills, because that thing that's always the same is always going to be a little different. So it's a little bit of a Where's Waldo thing. You get to spot something.
Yeah, for kids, it's fun to point out like, oh, that's new. That's different. They didn't do that before.
Well, and speaking of keeping the kids and their reactions to things in mind, obviously you want to keep kids entertained. You'd like for children to want to watch this show so that you can continue to make the show. And while I don't think you would label this, or I don't think Disney labels this an educational show, it strikes me that anytime you make a show that's targeting that audience, you're making an educational show to some extent, whether you mean to or not. So how do you deal with that responsibility?
You know, we're really lucky because we have such good partners with Marvel and with Disney and, you know, executives that we're working with. And we have an education team that kind of reviews everything that we're doing. From the earliest stage, from like, if we have like a springboard of like, we want to tell an episode where this happens, we send that. And, you know, we have our executives that weigh in, that gives us their point of view. But then the education team will also weigh in and say, this concept might be a little bit too complex. Or, like when we're turning in a script, they might say, oh, this language might be a little bit hard for them to understand. Can you simplify? So we're really lucky that, you know, we have that kind of backup. The other strength is I have been working in this space for a decade now. And so I do kind of know where that boundary is, where that line is. So it's always our goal to never cross that line and be able to make sure that the content that we're writing is accessible and in that way. The show is not what I would call like a PBS style preschool show. Those PBS styles are very much like, let's learn a lesson, and they might even talk directly to the audience kind of thing. One thing I really love about working at Disney Junior is the stories there really are about, it's story first, it's story and character first. And if on that journey of story and character, there's a lesson that you can kind of leave with, or a takeaway, or something you learn about, you know, helpfulness or cooperation or sharing, that kind of thing, then you have that. But it's never really like the focus. It should be about loving these characters and wanting to spend time in their world. But you are right. You do, when you're working with these kids, there is an inherent, you're just kind of teaching them about the world. And it's something I always kind of tell my writers when we're talking about, like, maybe you've learned to share a million times in your life, but the audience that we're teaching maybe hasn't heard the lesson it's nice to share yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so think about it that way. Think about it like, if you had never been taught to share, how would you want to teach? How would you want someone to express how to share?
That's a really good point. Unless we're actively raising kids at the moment, it's probably not something that you've had to consciously think about. I mean, you're probably not going to remember the point in your life where you learned to share. You were probably a little young, but at some point you ran into a situation and you learned a lesson. And that's very interesting as an adult to try to put yourself in the shoes of someone that young, which leads me to wonder, for generating an engaging story overall, when you're thinking about tone and theme and stakes, do you think about things in adult terms and then scale them down so that you get the kid-friendly version of adult-sized stakes? Or when you're working on a project like this, is it kid first? Do you start as the kid and you develop stakes that make sense to a kid? Is that the first step or the last step?
I think everybody might have a different point of view. Sure. On this, how they approach it. On our show specifically, we always wanted to kind of be, what's the kid point of view first? Like, what's the kid entry point? Because we never wanted to start with a concept or an idea that was already too big for them and have to pare it down. Because that, to me, that's a little bit harder. And then you might lose what you're trying to actually...
Oh, sure. Some things just may not scale down.
Yeah, some things might not scale down. I mean, yeah. When we first got on, we had some crazy ideas about like dams breaking and like all this kind of stuff. But as we started like exploring those, it was a little too big, a little bit too dramatic. The stakes were a little bit too real for a preschool audience. So we very quickly learned like, no, start with kids doing something kid relatable, wanting to go to a park or wanting to play at a park, something that kids in the real world would do every day. And then we elevated that by, okay, here's this real world thing that kids understand and are already familiar with. And then we added on the layer of like, okay, now it's a superhero Iron Man show. How do we take this everyday thing that kids know and how do we ratchet that up with Iron Man technology and Iron Man superpowers? And that was just a lot of fun to figure those kinds of things out. I have to be so careful because there's really good things, examples I have, but they haven't come out yet. So I have to be like, oh, don't talk about that one because that one's still coming. I'm trying to think like, it's just kids trying to play baseball and, you know, they love baseball and Ironheart creates an Iron Man style baseball bat that glows when you hit the ball. So it's just something that kids are already a little bit familiar with, playing sports, you know, being outside, playing with their friends, but here's this cool element to it. And then of course, supervillains show up and antics ensue.
Speaking of Ironheart, talking a little more industry now, how does the process of generating characters within these established universes work with the studio and all? Has this all been tricky? Because obviously you're not generating things that are quite canon here.
Yeah.
But you want the flavor. You want young Tony to have a certain starkness about him. Are these tricky things to work out with the studio, or do you have incredible latitude to do what you need to do?
It's both tricky and fun. I like to say, you know, these are some of the coolest toys in the toy box, and we're being offered the opportunity to play with them.
Oh, yeah.
But again, you have to play with them by, they're not our toys. They're somebody else's toys. So you have to play with their rules. So, you know, we were, again, just really lucky. It was always very collaborative working with Marvel, working with Disney, looking at like, okay, what heroes do they have available that aren't being used on other properties? There isn't something cool happening with them going off somewhere else in the MCU where we're not going to be stepping on anybody's toes? And then also from the Disney Junior perspective, what characters were going to work best for the audience at home to understand and get into this world? So we didn't have complete like, pick whatever Marvel characters you want and have fun with them. It was always a kind of a conversation of like, well, what about this character? Could we use this character? And then there'd be a discussion between all the parties. And then once we kind of landed on which characters we were going to use, then it became kind of up to us, you know, myself and the showrunner and the writing team to figure out how to present their voices in a way that are true to the characters, but kind of round off some of those darker, more mature edges that these characters are, you know, usually have in comic books, in MCU. You know, we always joke, like one of the most famous storylines is Tony Stark's alcoholism. That's the demon in the bottle is one of the most quintessential Iron Man storylines ever written. And obviously we could never go there. And we had a lot of internal jokes about, you know, the demon in the juice box, right, kind of a thing.
Drinking but, too much root beer. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, right. Tony, your root beer was becoming a problem. You know, we never actually did that, but we kind of have to laugh about those things because the show we're trying to make is a very sanitized, clean, preschool accessible version of something that in other hands and other spaces has been very dark and very heavy. So we like to have a lot of fun talking about that stuff. So it's been fun, you know, working on Young Jedi Adventures. That show was canon. Those characters and those spaces all exist in Star Wars lore. It's 300 years before the Skywalker saga. So we're very far removed from, you know, Anakin slaughtering all the younglings in the temple. So we were never going to deal with that. But you know, Yoda is a character on that show. And I got to write a script that really focused on Yoda having an adventure with some of these young Jedi. And that was a really exciting experience because, like, A, who gets to write for Yoda? Like, that's like a dream come true.
Awesome.
But you're also working very closely with the Lucasfilm team to make sure the voice sounds right and you're not stepping on anything that, oh, this contradicts something that's going to happen to Yoda 300 years from now.
Right. And by the way, wow, how fortunate are you getting to write in the Marvel Universe and the Star Wars Universe both? What happened? That's amazing.
I pinch myself a lot because I've been a big fan of this stuff my entire life. And I still remember my first day. I had just gotten the job on Young Jedi Adventures, and I got asked to come to do a meeting on the Disney lot in Burbank at the Lucasfilm space. And I'm driving up to the lot, and you have to go through the gate, right? And they ask you, like, oh, what's your name? What are you here for? And I'm like, oh, my name's James. I'm here for a meeting with Lucasfilm. And then I, like, caught myself saying that out loud, and I was like, that was the weirdest, like, I'm driving on to the Disney lot to be like, oh, you know, just having a meeting with Lucasfilm. And that, like, that's a moment that still to this day just, like, kind of blows my brain. Like, I think about, you know, 6, 7, 8-year-old me getting to be in these spaces, talking about these characters and just the fun of it, right? Like, we talk about it every day. We're like, how fun are we that we get to be in a room where we just get to be like, what crazy thing could we like make Iron Man do today? Or like, what crazy thing can we get Captain America up to? Like, this is what I would have done with my toys when I was 8. And now I get to do it as a fully grown adult.
Yeah.
Little James's dreams come true.
Yes. Very, 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 very much.
Was that your big yes moment, would you say then? Like, for you as like, because everybody has that big, you know, we all like to celebrate our little wins as writers, of course, but getting going on that lot and being like, I'm here for Lucasfilm, and then driving in and going, was that to you kind of the big, I'm on the journey, I'm here, this is part of the journey, and I'm going to accept it, and I'm going
to,
you know.
I think that was a big one. I definitely think that. I mean, getting to work and write on, it was a Young Jedi was such an amazing show, and I loved everybody I got to work with in my time on there. So getting to just getting that opportunity in the first place was a big high watermark in my career for me. I'd say there was, you know, there's been as a little tiny like thing that I always think about was like a big moment for me was the first time I was in a meeting that I wasn't the person taking the notes in the meeting. Cause coming up from production and working on the production side, I was always the person taking the meetings and the notes. And the first time I got asked to be in a writer's summit to talk about a new show that they were trying to work out and just come in and share ideas, you know, and I came down and I had my laptop and I was sitting there and I was ready. And then I kind of realized like, oh, they're not paying me to take notes in this meeting. They're paying me for my ideas in this meeting. And that was a big switch for me. And that to me was like, oh, I think I'm on my path now. Like I've moved up to that next level.
I love that.
And then suddenly there's someone in the room taking the notes who's taking you as seriously as you were taking those writers when you'd been in that position and Brave New World.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, wow, not that my opinion didn't matter before, but like my opinion was being valued in a different context at that level.
What would you picture yourself writing if for whatever reason you weren't writing? Well, let's say you're not writing for this age range anymore. Do you know the sort of thing that you would like to tackle? Would you like to stay within these cinematic universes? Would you like to go off and invent your own thing? What would you see yourself doing?
Yeah, I love getting to work with IP. It's such a fun and exciting experience because you're getting to work with a world that's already got a built-in audience, right? Like it's a little bit, it's always, it was weird, like working on Iron Man and like going into a store and there's already Iron Man toys on the shelf. And it's like, it's not exactly my show, but like the character is already so like omnipresent and everywhere. And that's just, to me, it's been a lot of fun when I've been asked to develop things that are based on, you know, well-known IP. It's a really fun experiment to tackle and figure out, especially like, how do you take an Iron Man show, take Iron Man as a character and develop it preschool? That was a really fun and exciting challenge that I had a lot of fun, like just a great time doing. With that being said, everybody has that desire to create that next big IP, to create that thing that like is a big world that other people will want to play in. So I definitely do have lots of series ideas that I think lean a little bit more four quadrant. I think they lean more full family. Not quite adult, as much as I love like adult animation and I think it's hilarious. Like, I don't think I could write that full time by myself.
Yeah.
I just like, I don't know if like that sense of style or humor, I like watching it. I don't know if I'd like writing it as much, just for me. I like stuff that kind of the whole family can get excited about. So I definitely have ambition to, you know, create new shows with my own characters, my own worlds, but also, you know, my next big dream is to write a feature animated film, you know, big musical, big world building.
Yes.
You know, I like somebody had to pitch K-pop Demon Hunters and right. Like, I want to pitch the next, not that exact story, but I want to pitch that next thing that can be that next big K-pop Demon Hunters. Don't follow the trend.
Right. Don't follow the trend, shape the trend, but you want to have developed that next cultural touchstone of the moment.
Yeah.
Sure. Why not?
Definitely. Because I also want just a bunch of toys in my office that are like original characters that
well,
I create.
Well, obviously.
That's really what I'm doing it for.
Yes.
It's just for the toys.
For our listeners that don't have visual of this, James has a wall of Easter eggs behind him. I see lightsabers, castles, are Marvel Studios. Are any of those from your show?
Yeah, there's an Iron Man, a Captain America, an Ultron, and Gamma, who's Iron Pup from my show right here. Then there's a lot more Marvel stuff up here, and then the rest of the room is also covered in toys. If I could turn the camera around, you would see like just Iron Man and his awesome friend toys like everywhere.
Oh, I respect that. Mad respect. Yeah.
James, is it true you own over 30,000 comic books?
It's a lot, and yes.
I mean, even your dogs are named. Am I correct on that?
That is correct. Sydney Bristow from Alias, the Jennifer Garner show, and Bruce Wayne, obviously, from Batman. Ed, my husband and I have been together for 20 years now. I've been collecting comics since I was about 8. So for, you know, 35-ish years.
It's just in your DNA.
And everywhere we've moved and, you know, we've lived in Georgia and Colorado and California. Like, we've lived everywhere. And everywhere we've moved, we've had to carry these giant long boxes of comic books around. And they're, you know, they're hidden under beds. They're hidden in closets. Like, you wouldn't come over here and see them, but they are everywhere. And my husband's like, do we have to keep moving these? And I'm like, they're going to be important one day. And like, now that I've actually like got a job writing comic book characters, I'm like, see, I told you it was all going to be worth it sometime.
That's great.
And that was all really exciting. It was really exciting because just being a lifelong comic book fan, last year I got asked to write the Iron Man and his awesome friends free comic book day comic. I got to have awesome meetings with Marvel, Marvel editors in New York City and talk about what this could be. And like, it's such a different way to writing for a comic book versus writing for an animated television show. But it was dream come true. And like walking into a comic book shop last May and like picking up my comic book off the shelf and like, oh my God, I got to write. This was definitely another one of those bucket lists. I made it moments.
In the process of creating that, did you end up working closely with the artist who was drawing the book?
Yeah, the team was really, really great. I didn't know exactly what to expect. I thought like maybe I would just write it and they would like take it off and like do everything else.
Sure.
But at every step, the editors would send the pages back to me and be like, oh, this is, you know, these are the pencils. Does this look good? Does this like work? Is this like hitting the story beats that you need? And then like, here's the inks and here's the color. So every time it was coming in, and it's fast. Like I wrote the script in November and it was basically finished by Christmas. Like all the art, everything done.
What? And that is staggering.
It was staggering. Again, I just told you, like, it took us almost 2 years to produce an episode of Iron Man and His Awesome Friends. Yep. And in like 6 weeks, we produced a 10-page comic book for Marvel, which was, and I getting to work with the artists and see what they were doing. And then also just how closely I'm tied to the show to be able to be like, oh, actually, you know, Ultron shit looks more like this than this, and be able to provide that context for them was a lot of fun.
Wow, that is a great story. I'm not particularly a comic book nerd, but I still find that story incredibly exciting, getting to see how that whole process goes. Wow. Jealous over here. Plus, jealous of the whole, here, take a moment away from doing the thing you normally do to write for a different format, for a slightly different audience, for slightly different reasons, but still get to use the characters in the world that you're familiar with. That's got to tickle your brain in a fun way.
It definitely did. When I got the offer, I think I went screaming out of my office with excitement. I think my husband probably thought the house was on fire. He was like, what's going on? I'm like, I get to write a comic book.
That is a beautiful story.
Your whole career is such an embodiment of just like what you love and your passions. And I think it's so important, especially when you said, you know, I'm doing this for little James. He would be so happy. I'm writing with Iron Man, I'm writing all these cool characters. And I think it just really goes to show that passion is the way to go. Follow your passion, follow your heart. And that's really true from you. So thanks for sharing
that,
James.
Thank you. Yeah. I think I've always, I kind of don't know how to be anything else. Like, this is kind of my energy all the time. Like, I know I'm a lot, I love the things I love, and I'm excited about the things I'm excited about. And that energy and enthusiasm has been something that has kind of carried me through from each job to each job, because, you know, the people who I'm working with see that enthusiasm as soon as I've walked in the door. And I know that I've been told that by the showrunner and the supervising director on Elaine of Avalor. When I walked in to interview to be their production secretary, they were both like, oh, this guy's got all the energy we want to be on our show.
Wow.
And they told me that themselves. And it was a really funny moment, because like, I don't see myself as being anything. I'm like, well, this is just like, who doesn't go into an interview with enthusiasm and excitement? Like, I was being interviewed to work on an animated show for Disney. Of course I'm going to be excited.
Yeah.
And apparently that wasn't the case with the other applicants. But, you know, I'm glad I came in and made an impression.
Well, I don't have any kids. I don't have otherwise reason that I would probably be exposed to the shows. But I've watched yesterday and today and was terribly impressed by the vibe of it, the message of it, the characterizations, and though I realize this is out of your domain a bit, the art style and everything of the shows, they're just really nicely done. And if we've got people out in our audience that have kids who might dig this kind of thing, they should absolutely be checking it out.
Thank you.
I was watching Young Jedi earlier today, and it was a scene with the youngling standing around, and my wife walked into the room and she said, what are you watching? I said, hang on, I think Anakin's about to come in. And
you're awesome. The first person that's ever made that joke about the show.
I'm sure. Oh, man. Before we let you go, one little question. We've certainly got some emerging writers in our audience here who might have an interest in getting into animation and or writing for this age range that you're currently writing for. Would you have a bit of advice for how these people might best show off what it is they can do, maybe in pursuit of getting staffed in a writer's room or something like that?
Yeah, one thing I always tell, you know, young writers coming up, specifically in animation, because again, animation is a medium. It's not like it's not locked into one thing.
Sure.
So an idea that I always tell them is come up with a concept that you think is cool, write it for a preschool audience, write it for that 6-11 action adventure kind of four quadrant audience, and then write it for an adult animated audience.
Oh, interesting.
It's a really fun writing exercise to take like characters and worlds and take them from the youngest possible to the foul-mouthed, dirty adult animated comedy version of them. And mostly because you never know where you're going to be in a situation where somebody might be like, oh, we're looking for somebody that can write preschool, or we're looking for somebody who can write a little older. And then you immediately have those samples. You immediately have those scripts to share to be like, oh, look, I can write a preschool script, but I can also write this four quadrant, 6-11 family adventure animated film, or I can write this, you know, adult animated comedy type thing. And that at least shows like your breadth of skill, but it also shows like your creativity. And then it gives you multiple samples and fun. It's just a fun like experiment to be like, how do I take these baby characters? And again, they don't have to stay babies in the adult version, but like, how do you take that core concept and that core world and develop it in multiple ways? To me, as like a story editor, as somebody who's reading people, if you can show me that range and that skill, because even if we're not writing comedy that dark and adult for preschool, to be able to show you've got some comedy chops and you're looking at things in different ways.
Yeah.
All of that kind of helps each other. It shows me you've got those skills. Yeah.
Wow. I am so glad I asked, because, you know, everybody knows, oh, you should have some things in some different genres and things, blah, 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 in your portfolio. But I've never before heard the advice, write it for different age ranges, the same material. So yeah, anybody who wants to tackle that, it seems like that would be a really powerful thing to have around. And you learn a little something about your material, and maybe you'd learn a little something about yourself along the way.
Exactly.
Well, James, thank you so, so much for your time today. This has been really fun chatting, and we will absolutely be keeping an eye out for whatever you're doing next. Then I hope you get to develop your own IP at some point. That's exciting.
Yeah. We all need to collect those toys.
Yeah, exactly.
We do.
Again, thank you so very much for your time, and we'll hope to talk to you again one of these days.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much, James.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. You know, it's kind of easy to predict how much I'm going to enjoy talking to people who write the same sorts of things that I write, or the sorts of things that I watch and read. That wasn't the case here, that there's a lot of overlap between his world and mine, but so much of his advice was so applicable no matter what you write, genre or age range or any of that. So many great stories and great insight and great advice, no matter what kind of writer you are. Fantastic.
Absolutely agree. Anybody who writes should write because it's all they want to do, and they're doing it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like James, he writes for himself. He doesn't write for anybody else.
James knows who he is and why he's doing what he does. And I absolutely loved his specific advice about building up your portfolio by adapting the same piece multiple times for different age ranges. I mean, for anybody in our audience who might take that advice, if you've got that in your portfolio when you get in the room, that really says something.
Absolutely. And I believe if anybody has any children in the age or yourself, if you want to check out James's work, I believe he has a new season of the Marvel's Iron Man and His Awesome Friends releasing.
Right about now?
Right about now. Just as we're launching the episode, yeah.
Fantastic. So, yes.
So, I know Brian intrigued, Brian's going to be bundled up on his couch with his popcorn, ready to go.
I will be preparing myself to binge. Thank you very much. And with that, a big
no spoilers.
Yes, no spoilers. And with that, a big final thanks to our guest this episode, James Eason Garcia. And thanks as well to Story Summit for making this podcast possible. To meet other writers, turbocharge your craft, and learn about career opportunities writers really care about, it does not get any better than the generous people at Story Summit. Please take a moment to check them out now at storysummit.us. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep writing. And if writing is your career goal, please keep in mind that you'll be told no more than anything else. But please don't give up. because all it takes is that one yes. I've been your host, Brian Landwehr. This episode produced by myself and Bailey Patterson with the support of David Paul Kirkpatrick of Story Summit.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Original music by Kenton Edwards.